and you'd get your mission cards all filled out because you already knew who was going to be flying what airplane, not what airplane, but who was going to be flying lead, number two, number three, number four. And we, in our combat, in fact, in all the fighter operations, we always fly as two sections. You got your lead and number two. And in the Air Force, leads would be here, and number two would be on the left wing. Then number three would be on the right wing, and number four on his wing. And three and four would sort of operate independently, but not totally. But they were still, that was a flight. And so you'd all get together, you know who's doing it, and you'd get everything pre-briefed, then you'd go and try to get some sleep, because we generally had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I remember over Thailand, a lot of this was during the monsoons, and I mean the rain would be just pouring down, and you'd be going to to try to get some breakfast, and they did have breakfast for us, and then we'd go and do our big brief, because on these Hanoi missions, you'd go in always a minimum of four flights of four D models. The D's were the strike airplanes, and I'm segregating that from the F model because the F model became Weasels. The Weasel aircraft, the two-seaters, they had a weapons operator in the back, electronic warfare operator, because those are the guys that went after the SAMs. They had all the electronics to look for SAMs, and they carried strike missiles and CBUs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they'd be looking for those guys. So we would generally always have four strike flights of Ds carrying bombs, CBUs, et cetera, when we went to Hanoi. And then you'd have the Weasel flight, which would operate independently, actually. And if we were flying up over Hanoi, we generally would have a MIG-CAP flight out of Ubon Air Base, which was on the easternmost part of Thailand, right near the Mekong in Laos. And they would provide F-4s rigged up strictly for air-to-air MIG-CAP, to try to intercept the MIGs if they were in the area. So that would be the typical setup. Then you'd go after the main debrief. Everybody would brief the thing. The force commander, who would be the lead guy leading us all in, would tell us what we're going to do, and so forth. After the big brief, we'd go back to our individual squadron units, and we'd cover. At that point, we knew what airplane we were flying, and so we'd put that on our mission cards. And any final details that we'd get a big weather brief in the big briefing that we were at. They'd give us all the weather and what to expect. And then we would go to the equipment shack, get our survival vest, our parachutes, or put our G-suits on, and then go out to the aircraft. They did take us out to the airplanes, and we'd do our walk-arounds with our crew chiefs and climb aboard. And then at a certain particular time, because of the number of airplanes all starting up at the same time, most jet engines are started by air that's pumped into the engine, and it starts spinning the engine up to a certain point. It gets to about 10%. You bring the fuel on and ignition, and then it starts, and then it's self-generating at that point, and it runs on up to idle, which is right around 60%, 58%, something like that. I can't remember the exact numbers, and not that it really matters at this point, but so that would be typical. So at the specified time to start, everybody would be, if you could see lead aircraft, and generally you could in most cases, you'd see when he hits his button, we had a pyrotechnic charge that they actually put in the belly of the airplane that had this hot, hot, hot expanding gas that would actually do the start. And it was much, much faster than the general air cart that you'd use any other time. And so as soon as you saw his smoke, bam, you'd hit it. Otherwise, you had a clock that was running, and everybody synchronized their clocks, and you'd, if you didn't see it, perhaps because of the wind or rain or whatever, then you'd start on time. You'd get the airplane up running. The crew chief would do the checks with you. You'd come up on the radio. You'd talk, and everybody would check in. And then when it came time to taxi out, he'd call taxi. So you taxi out, and you'd stay right in your order, 1, 2, 3, 4. We go out there then from there to the arming area where they would actually, the weapons guys would pull the pins on the bombs or whatever you were carrying, and then you'd wait for your takeoff. And you'd be taken off, like if you were the fourth flight, then all these other guys would be in front of you, four flights of four, and they'd pull out on the runway, lead would go, and you'd wait 5 seconds, two, three, four. And then, so you'd have a long string of airplanes taking off, and you had to keep everybody in sight. You had to keep your lead in sight because you had to join up. And a lot of times, the weather would really be nasty. And I can remember taking off and having to join underneath a 1,000-foot overcast, and it's raining. So you know, when you're in that environment, I can promise you one thing: you are at your best that you will ever be as a pilot. You had to be. You could not be anything less than that. It was a very demanding job. But, you know, that's who we were. We were fighter pilots, and that's the challenge that we loved. And so you'd get joined up as a flight, and you'd stay together. Then you'd go to the tanker. You'd refuel, and then you'd stay with the tanker until you got ready to drop off. The force commander would actually call the drop-off. And so you'd stay with the tanker, and you'd cycle through. The good thing about the F-105, it was probably the most easy airplane to refuel that was ever built. If you look at any pictures, when you look at some of the new airplanes, the receptacle is always back behind the cockpit. And the F-4 Phantom, that's where it was. There's two types of refueling. There's a probe that actually sticks out just like that right there, and that one used a basket. It would have a big old basket about that big around, and we called it poke and duck. And you'd drive your airplane in to hit that drogue, and that's how you'd refuel if you were refueling that way. Or the tanker would have a probe that they actually extended down from the back end of the airplane, and they would stick it into your receptacle. And the 105's receptacle was right here, right in front of you. And so, I mean, you just drive in there. All you're doing is just flying formation. It was just a piece of cake. So you could cycle a flight of 105s through a tanker so quick it'd make your head spin. Nobody ever say a word in that environment. Everything was silent. And you'd go through it, and everybody knew what they were doing. And like I said, that's when you're at the top of your game. Everybody was professionals. And there wasn't any question when you were going to Hanoi what you were doing. And then we drop off. The force commander would call. Everybody drop off. Now we're coming inbound. The Weasels would be dropping off ahead of us. They would be looking for the radars, the signatures from the SAMs and the guns. And you start hearing these guys call out, "We got sweeping guns. We got SAMs, SAM radars up." And boy, your stomach. I'm telling you guys, your stomach has never been any tighter, nor your mouth any drier than this point, time, and space. Because you know what you're up against, and you know what you're going to be facing when you got to that target. And so, you know, you're getting nervous. You're not getting nervous. I mean, you really are. And anybody that says otherwise, once again, don't even listen to them.
You were holding the airplane up by the seat of your pants.
You better believe it. Then we'd get into the target area itself, and this is where it really you had to really, really pay attention, because, you know, the Weasels would still be out there, and they'd be calling these SAM radars, and they'd be giving us a clock position from the force where these radars were looking. So now we're looking over there, keeping our eyes out on the ground. What you see when a SAM is launched, you wouldn't see the SAM if you didn't see, at least, all right, I'm going to rephrase that. I never saw a SAM unless I saw it launch. The damn things hit Mach 2 in that quick. And so, but on the ground, when they launch, it leaves a huge smoke, dust, and everything else. So that's what you're looking for. And then you try to get a vector, because it did carry a trail of smoke behind it. And so you're looking for that stuff, and then the flak, deadly. And it was so thick sometimes, and I really mean this. You would think you could get out of the airplane and walk on it.